Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Applebee Bermuda Shorts podcast, short talks on all things Bermuda and business. In this Tech Talk series, we are going to talk about what's happening in the world of tech. I'm Jerome Wilson, head of Applebee's technology and innovation practice in Bermuda. Hello, so today I'm joined by Hannah Tilsley, who is one of the partners in our dispute resolution team. Hello, Hannah.
Hi, Jerome.
How are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. Are you feeling nervous?
You know what? I am feeling nervous, but I'm equally feeling like this is going to launch a podcast career for me. Spotify is going to be on the phone. $10 million. I'm not. My ambitions are low. $10 million. I'll do it for $10 million, Spotify, if they're listening.
Well,
you know, the law will become a hobby. I moved to California. This is the start of something big for me. So.
So today we're going to talk about something that's very interesting, and you know, Hannah is going to lead us in that discussion. But for those of you who are listening, and for those of you who have listened to our previous podcast, we more or less cover the state of play in Bermuda as it relates to the digital asset business and how it interacts with our practice and what we're seeing on a day-to-day basis. Hannah is an expert at the courts. She is one of our leading practitioners here in Bermuda, and you know, today we want to talk about just how the courts have been linking and looking at, rather, digital assets and how they feel about digital assets. Now, we can never predict what a judge is going to say. Judges are humans. They have different minds. They have different ideas. And they all look at and interpret legislation slightly different. But today we want to at least give you, our listeners, some sort of understanding of what the courts in Bermuda may do if there is a question in relation to digital assets. So we're going to go through a couple of things. I think first we're going to go through some of the principles of digital assets and what makes them property. That's one of the questions that you will hear throughout this podcast, is whether or not they're property. The importance of that is if they are, they are, that simplifies matters for the courts. We'll set the table with that, Hannah, and then I think you have some court cases that you'll want to take us through and talk about the importance of those cases.
That's exactly it. We're going to look at the cases we do have about digital assets, mm-hmm. and try and have a think about what's going to happen in Bermuda when this question crops up. Because exactly. Part of the sort of issue we have in Bermuda is that our Supreme Court, which is the court that's going to hear these cases, it's the sort of court of first instance, mm-hmm. for any matter worth more than $25,000, which a digital assets case always certainly is going to be worth more than that.
We
very much hope. That court hasn't considered any digital assets cases as yet. Now, it might have some in the works.
Understood.
It might have had some hearings on some, but it hasn't led to any reported judgments, which is what we as litigators look at to see what the law is about.
Okay, so no reported cases so far in Bermuda.
Yeah, that's where we land. So we've got to think about, well, what is the Bermuda court going to do when it comes to consider digital assets?
Right.
And is always the case in Bermuda when you come to look at something and you can't find any Bermuda authority with an answer on it. Usually we then turn to other common law countries, usually starting with England and Wales, you know, the motherland, as it were. Probably the busiest court system in the common law world. Lots and lots of commercial judgments coming out of London, obviously.
Yep.
So that's the first place we look. But we'll also look to other comparative jurisdictions. So Singapore, Cayman, New Zealand, Australia. We're not limited.
Would Canada be included in that?
Yeah, Canada definitely be included. And when we come to argue a case before the Bermuda court, we're going to be able to say, look, there's no precedent here, but here are some cases we found. These are how judges have approached it in other places. And, you know, we commend that approach to you. This is what we think you should do in Bermuda. Bermuda court's not bound to do that, can completely go its own way if it wants to.
Right.
But in all likelihood, it's going to look at what other judges have done. And take a sort of have that jumping off point.
Understood.
For what we do here on island.
What about jurisdictions that are not specifically Commonwealth? So like United States, for example, we know that there's a lot of digital asset action going on there, or sort of, you know, other countries that are not Commonwealth. How would those factor in?
They have different systems of law, so it's not possible to say. So, for example, if one looks at an English case, chances are that the sort of genesis of that English case is going to be some historic case from the 19th century, which is for better or for worse, going to be incorporated into Bermuda's common law by virtue of the fact that we used to, you know, we are in overseas territories of the United Kingdom.
Absolutely.
Whereas in the US, they obviously have a constitution and a state federal system, a whole baffling world of things going on over there. What you can use those kinds of authorities to show, though, is to say commercially, practically, how are other courts dealing with these assets?
Got you.
Because what we don't want to do, and what, you know, judges are usually keen not to do, is to give decisions that close down commercial business avenues.
Right.
And that's certainly with digital assets, and in some of the cases we're going to talk about, you can see judges really being very mindful of the fact that if they go with a very closed, defined view of the property world and the asset world, they're going to start to really restrain the way digital assets can be used. They're going to start to limit the way people can make claims over them. And of course, if you find out, actually, I have this cryptocurrency, someone hacks my account, and I can't get an order against the, you know, the exchange that holds it. I can't get a freezing injunction to stop it from moving further, you know, further out of my control.
Right.
I can't get any of these orders, which would ordinarily be available to me with money, shares, property.
Yeah.
If you can't do any of that, you're going to be reluctant to buy crypto. And the courts don't want to sort of stifle this whole new area of real capital that we have developed and that is developing. So
no, that's really interesting. And that to my ears sounds like the courts are therefore being pretty cautious and pretty open with their interpretation of crypto so far. And they're not taking these very difficult, narrow views, which is good. Which is good both for, as you pointed out, customers who want to purchase these assets and have certainty that if anything goes wrong, there's going to be a way, an avenue for them to get some recourse. And also for companies who are providing services in this space, for them to know that, okay, there is a court system out there that is taking practical approaches to this whole new sort of, I mean, this really is a new form of thing,
yeah,
as it were, that has come up very, very quickly in the last, you know, 5-10 years. And so down to the nitty gritty, why everyone's actually tuned in now to hear, what are some of the things that you are seeing that are occurring in some of these courts outside of our shores?
So I think the major theme in the cases that there have been so far, and I should say there really haven't been that many cases.
Okay.
And there certainly haven't been very many cases that have gone to trial. So a lot of the judgments we have are injunction applications, so freezing injunctions and things like that, where really that happens at the start of a case. You know, you've been the victim of some form of fraud, or something's happened and you've said, all right, what I need to do before I do anything else, before I make my claim, I need to make sure my assets or what remains of them don't go anywhere. Because if they get dissipated, I can, you know, I'm going to buy myself a very expensive piece of paper in the form of a judgment, and I'm not going to get, you know, I'll pay all of my lawyer's fees and I will have nothing to show for it at the end.
Are they my particular assets, or are they the assets of the company themselves? Because, you know, the nature of digital assets is that, you know, once they are traceable, they're the public blockchain is there. But then you may not, once they're gone, you cannot sometimes tell who has that wallet or, you know, who owns that wallet. So
what the cases have found is that digital assets, certainly in the form of at least cryptocurrency, so okay, Bitcoin, Ethereum, and in a very recent case, at a very early stage, NFTs as well.
Oh, interesting.
Are a form of property. Property, really, when we speak about in a legal sense, is really my legal right of holding something. So
okay,
we're not talking, you know, if we talk about a mobile phone, the mobile phone is the thing, but the property in a legal sense is my entitlement to have and own and do with what I want with my own mobile phone.
Understood.
So they've found that these coins belong to, you know, the individuals that own them, not the exchanges that are holding them, not the people that created them, but the individuals that are holding them, and that they can therefore be traced. Obviously, with tracing, you need to be able to demonstrate, as you say, if things start to get mixed, tracing becomes...
Yeah, it becomes
impossible.
Yeah.
If not hard, depending on the situation, it's quite complicated areas, but very difficult. But at least, you know, I can make the application. I'm not going to fall at the first hurdle because the court's going to say, well, actually, this isn't property at all.
So these have been judgments that have actually been handed out. And Are you able to tell us a little bit more about sort of what was the end result, or any sort of who these companies were? Were they UK-based companies, or did they just have customers in the UK? What was the nexus to the
Yeah, so we can go through them. I thought it might help to start just with a short sort of property overview.
Sure.
We'll go back to law school with you, Jerome, and with the listeners.
That's fine.
For those of you who didn't go to law school, you're about to learn something. Properties. Complicated area of law. There's not a clear definition of it in English or Bermuda law. Some statutes define it. So the Theft Act obviously has to define property because you're going to convict someone of stealing it. And it does so widely because we don't want someone to take something they shouldn't have done and then get away with it because they say, well, it wasn't technically property.
Right.
It's just not, you know, we're not interested.
It kind of existed, this thing, and it's kind of mine now, so whatever.
Exactly. So there are some statutory definitions within their own context. And then there's the common law. And at common law, we start with an English case called National Provincial Bank and Ainsworth, which is a case from 1965. So already you can see a judge, Lord Wilberforce, who is an eminent commercial judge.
He's a rock star.
Yeah, exactly. Like every common law lawyer is going to have heard of Lord Wilberforce. But when Lord Wilberforce heard this case in 1965, he was not in any respect contemplating a world with crypto or digital assets or probably the handheld home computer. Like, it's just, that's
different time.
Exactly.
Quite literally.
So, and yet the principles in that case will always be our jumping off point until such time as the English court says, you know what, it's not good law anymore.
Let's put that aside.
Yeah, exactly. So, and he set them out to his credit, because it seems to me judgments have just got longer and more complicated as time's gone on, whereas this is, to his credit, very, very short. Before a right or interest can be admitted into the category of property or of a right affecting property, it must be, and then we have four things, definable, identifiable by third parties, capable in its nature of assumption by third parties, and have some degree of permanence or stability. So
that's sort of the pillars of property, as you were, like, you know, everything is, I don't have them here to mind, but assumption meaning they can be taken.
Yep, exactly.
Certainty, they can be traceable. You know, so yeah, that seems to be as good a definition as property as ever.
Exactly. And if we start with Ainsworth, if you don't meet the Ainsworth requirements, you're not property.
Gotcha. That's
you're done with the argument. You leave the building and you're finished. But it's what we call a negative definition. So just because you meet it, that doesn't mean you're property either.
Okay.
You then still, it's still a case by case consideration, depending on the property we're discussing.
I'm intrigued.
So you can imagine that digital assets obviously have, as soon as they've come before the courts in every case, every judge pretty much has asked the question, but are they property?
The judge goes through that test and says, okay, these are the four pillars. It applies to your cryptocurrency or to your digital asset. Then what's next?
So if the four Ainsworth categories apply and the court determines that, and that's part of the issue because so many of the English judgments we have are interlocutory judgments that have been made on injunctions where the court says there's an arguable case it's property. So that's enough for you to get your injunction, but the ultimate determination doesn't happen until trial.
Understood.
That can be many years away. You may never get there if the case settles, if someone decides to drop the litigation because it becomes uncommercial and so on. So you're kind of dependent on cases proceeding through the courts, getting to trial for you to have judge-made law, common law. And so far, there's only one trial I found, and it's in New Zealand, but we're gonna talk about it because it's an interesting case. The other issue with property is we have the Ainsworth criteria. And then we have the fact that, again, traditionally, English law says there are only two types of property.
Okay.
Things in possession, so physical, tangible, movable things, houses, cars, mobile phones.
Yep.
And then things in action, so things over which we have a legal right, so debts.
Shares,
yeah. Exactly. A right to sue for breach of contract is a thing in action.
Yep.
And again, digital assets don't fit really very neatly.
Interesting.
Into either of those two boxes.
Is that's what the courts have determined?
That's what the courts have determined. Some judges have said, well, they're things in action.
Yeah.
One judge has said they're neither of these things, but these two categories are arbitrary and we shouldn't worry too much about the fact that they seem to fall outside of them.
Because I like that judge.
Yeah, no, exactly. Because again, the case that says these two categories of property are it. It's from 1886.
Wow.
So again, you're not. It's a judge that's not contemplating anything like this. And also, it's when one reads the judgment, you think, did he really mean to say it's this or bust? Or, or in fact, on a proper reading, is that not really what this judgment is getting at?
Understood.
And I think a lot of the judges who've looked at it have said it's probably not what he's getting at.
Yeah.
And then by analogy, there are some cases. For example, there's a case in 2000 about milk quotas where a judge found that a milk quota was property. So again, a judge has said, well, by that's not tangible. It's not clearly a thing in possession. It's not clearly a thing in action. But that was found to be property. So why can't digital assets be?
I would say digital assets seem more to be
even more tangible to me than a milk quota. And the same thing with European carbon credits. Again, they've been found to be property, kind of again more akin to the digital asset space. So pretty much an example of a judge saying, like, we've got to keep up with the times here. we can't just throw out the baby with the bathwater because we can't fit neatly.
Yeah.
And as I say, when one of these cases goes to trial, I would fully expect there to be a very lengthy, detailed reasoned judgment all about how do we grapple with digital assets and these old rules.
So that on that point, I think that, you know, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but we have the potential with the sort of first real substantive case on digital assets to pretty much rewrite the law or the case history on what is property.
I think so. I think judges would stay away from the term rewrite because judges, of course, would say, well, judges don't make law. We just interpret existing law.
Okay.
And, you know, Parliament or in Bermuda's case, our legislature, they make the law.
Understood.
So I think they would say, well, actually, what we've realized is that the existing law is, in fact, wider than we previously thought.
So a rethink
of the law, right? So, I fully expect them to rethink the law and say, well, of course, Lord Wilberforce in 1965 was contemplating digital assets, you know, in mind that we might eat. Exactly.
He was a rock star, but I don't know if he was that prescient.
He's a science fiction thinker as well, apparently. So there will be a rethink about.
Gotcha.
and a sort of a long, lengthy discussion, I'm sure, about. And I think in the New Zealand case we're going to discuss, there's a little bit of that, albeit not. Perhaps not as much maybe as there will be when it gets to, because I'm sure again it'll go to the English High Court and then it'll almost certainly be appealed to the English Court of Appeal, and possibly to the English Supreme Court.
Okay, so where do we go to next then? So we've had the two types of the two types of property.
We come to. I also just wanted to talk about sort of again the two types of property is one of the main problems, quote unquote, that the courts have flagged with digital assets because we don't seem to fit neatly into either. Mm-hmm. But the sort of second problem is that English law is very clear that information is not property.
Okay.
So we've created certain categories of law to get around that. So we have intellectual property that you can have claims in that. You can have claims in copyright.
Gotcha.
Claims in trademarks, claims in confidentiality, all of which helps us to sort of be able to make claims about information. But information itself is not property.
Understood.
It makes sense because unlike a house, you know, I can have information and my having it doesn't stop you from having it in its entirety as well.
Yes.
Which property has to have that.
Distinctive, you know.
Yeah, exclusory.
Stop here, mine, start here.
Exactly. And again, on a pure reading, judges have thought, well, hang on a minute, isn't a digital asset it's just a series of numbers in a computer? Isn't that just pure information? And if that's right, then it can't be property. Now, again, in the cases we'll look at, judges have said, well, no. That's it's plainly not correct to look at it that way.
Yeah.
And a reductive looking at it, reductively looking at it in that way is
wrong.
It's just...
Because you can put it on a cold storage wallet and have it offline and, you know, no one else has access to it.
Exactly. And people are buying and selling it. You know, it's just not,
It's not ubiquitous. Everyone doesn't have it. I mean, it would be nice if everyone had a Bitcoin, but no one.
It would be very nice if everyone had a Bitcoin.
But it is not, it doesn't work that way.
Yeah. So, but these are the problems. These are kind of headline problems that the courts have grappled with and are going to continue to grapple with before we eventually get a judgment that probably kind of closes off some of these points. or we get some sort of law reform. Yeah. I mean, it's possible. In the UK, the Law Commission is exploring, it's consulting at the moment on the possibility of doing an entirely new act to create a new form of property in the form of digital assets. But we'll see. So let's talk about the cases.
Yep.
So we start with a case in England, which is probably the lengthiest English case so far on some of these issues. It's December 2019, and it's AA. It was an anonymized case.
Okay.
AA and persons unknown. It was heard by Mr. Justice Bryan. It concerns an insurance company that was hacked.
Right.
And the hackers said, we will give you the code to release the hack on your system if you pay us £950,000, or the equivalent of £950,000 in Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Which they duly did, because they wanted their systems back. They pretty much immediately launched proceedings to try and injunct the exchange holding the Bitcoin. They thought they knew which accounts it had gone into. They tried to restrain the Bitcoin that was in those accounts to stop it from going anywhere. So again, we're looking at injunctive applications in the early stage of proceedings. One of the questions considered by the judge was, well, can I injunct Bitcoin? Because I can only injunct something if it's property.
Right.
And he had a look at, Mr. Justice Bryan had a look at whether Bitcoin was property in this case. And again, he sort of sets out the problems, I think, quite well. And I'll read it, because it's a fairly short paragraph. The first and perhaps fundamental question arises in relation to this claim is whether or not, in fact, the bitcoins, which are being held in the account of the second defendant, are property at all. Mm-hmm. Prima facie, there is a difficulty in treating bitcoins and other cryptocurrencies as a form of property. They are neither choses in possession, so things in possession, nor are they things in action. So what we've talked about, those two arbitrary categories that arise from the 1885 case. They are not choses in possession because they are virtual. They're not tangible and they cannot be possessed. They are not choses in action because they do not embody any right capable of being enforced by action. Mm-hmm. That produces a difficulty because English law traditionally views property as being of only two kinds. And then he cites the 1885 case I've mentioned. And that 1885 case is very simple. All personal things are either possessions or actions. The law knows no tertium quid between the two, which is a piece of Latin I had to look up, and it means third element.
Oh, very smart guy.
So, yeah, no, exactly. So he sort of sets out that's really the problem that the courts are, when they come to have final hearings on some of these issues, going to have to grapple with. We've got all this case law. It says you've got to fit into these categories, and we can't easily fit digital assets into it. But ultimately, where the judge lands is that this is property.
Okay.
And that it could be made subject to the injunction.
And what did he use to, having so eloquently set out what the law was, what did he use to explain that it was property?
So he went through, again, some of those more modern cases about our milk quota and the carbon credits and so on. And basically concluded that Fry LJ, who was the 1885 judge, you know, hadn't intended to reduce the categories in this way, and that actually you could fall outside those categories, or perhaps fall within them, but perhaps those categories are more than they say they are.
Yeah, they're more fluid and not so determinative.
Exactly. I mean, I have a real problem with the intangibility thing, because, you know, just because I can't pick up my crypto or hang it on my wall or have it in my house, you still... It's difficult because it's still a thing that's there, and I can trade it with someone. I
agree with you, because the right to it still exists. Or you buy crypto on an exchange, it's custodied in a wallet on your behalf. It's just like saying I don't have any cash in the bank, because no one dollar bill rather has my name on it. And so I see it the same way, where it's custodied and you have that right because of your agreement and for signing up to that platform to the number of cryptocurrency, Bitcoin, whatever you have there, you have the right and to that asset, to that item, as it were.
Yeah.
So I think that when you look at it like that, hearing that it's not intangible or saying that it's not intangible, I mean, these judges are presumably advised by some of the smartest and brightest minds in this space. So presumably someone's saying to them, well, actually, this is how it works, I would hope. But thankfully, he came to the right answer.
Yeah, he gets there. He very much gets there in the end. And he places a lot of reliance on, there are a number of sort of number of entities in the UK doing research on crypto who are going through all the case law and who are obviously sort of in the background advocating for the recognition of all of these things. Because they recognize that it's a potentially whole new aspect of the economy, right? And if judges shut it down by virtue of their decisions, that's a problem.
So in this case, they were able to injunct the defendants. Now, whether or not they actually recovered their crypto is another thing, because as you said, it's difficult to actually trace. But at least they got some legal victory in the matter, it sounds.
Yeah, they did. They got this victory. And then the judge went also on to consider the Ainsworth criteria. So that's AA, which is probably the leading English case on this question about property rights and crypto having property rights.
Understood.
And then the lengthiest judgment, certainly that I've come across in my reading on this subject, is from New Zealand, a case called Rusco and Cryptopia Limited in liquidation.
I like that name.
I know, all the names are always fantastic. This arises in liquidation, insolvency. So
things had already gone bad.
So it's a large crypto token exchange, and it went into voluntary liquidation after losing a significant quantity of its crypto tokens when it was hacked. So, things aren't going that great. The question before the New Zealand High Court was whether the crypto tokens that remained with the company, whether they were assets of the company, i.e. that could be distributed to the company's creditors, or whether they properly belonged to their, quotes, owners. And that they can only belong to their owners if their property, the property of those. It's strange to talk about owners when you may not have property, but you know what
the
I mean.
Who the people have the right holding to them,
exactly. The people who have the right to them. So that was the question that the court considered. And it there were lots of other sort of interesting trust related questions. I mean, there was a whole facet of elements of this judgment. And, you know, certainly for any lawyers out there who are listening, who are dealing with these issues or want to read a judgment that's more comprehensive in lots of different ways, this is, I think, probably the one to read.
Okay.
So, but what I'm interested in is those things we've already talked about. So, you know, how did they deal with the Ainsworth question? How did they deal with the information question and the property and shows property in action question? So the court found that the Ainsworth criteria were met in relation to these crypto tokens. And went through in much more detail. So obviously in AA, the judge deals with it very summarily and says, they're not a problem. So the court in New Zealand absolutely satisfied that the crypto was identifiable subject matter. Not a question there. Computer readable strings of characters recorded on networks of computers established for the purpose of reading those strings are, as I see it, sufficiently distinct to be capable of being allocated uniquely to an account holder on that particular network.
And that's the right answer.
Yeah, it's got to be the right answer. And there's a lot more. I mean, there's paragraphs of analysis here sort of going into the great detail about how this crypto particularly worked and so on. But it just makes sense. And there's sort of, you imagine being, you know, you're in New Zealand, this is your, you know, you've got your stuff with Cryptopia, and there might be a chance that they say, well, actually, you won't get your crypto back.
It will just
go into the general assets of this company. You obviously you're thinking, well, this is plainly the right outcome, and it's how I've been treating this stuff. Again, clearly identifiable by third parties. The court put a lot of emphasis on the fact that the sort of a public key to access the crypto and a private key to get to it, you need to link the two up. So, you know, it's identifiable.
That's where your right stop and mine.
Yeah,
exactly.
And a third party can't come along with their own key and get access to... The two must match. So, again, no issue in holding it was identifiable by third parties. The easy one for the New Zealand court, I think, was capable of assumption by third parties, because the judge was like, it's being traded left, right, and center. Of course, it's capable of assumption by third parties. We
and
see
you
it.
Want to transfer it to the creditors, so yeah.
Exactly. That's exactly it. So the judge pretty briefly dealt with that one.
Yeah.
And then the final one, some degree of permanence or stability. It's an interesting point, because the judge made the point that we shouldn't overstate the need for permanence or stability. You gave the example of a football ticket.
Yep.
That it, you know, you can buy it on the day of the match, and it, once you've had the match, the ticket no longer has any value or any relevance.
Yep.
But that doesn't stop it from being property during that short period of time.
Yep.
For sure. So again, I mean, he actually said the blockchain methodology of crypto means that its permanence is vastly you know, much, much wider and more distinct than something like a football ticket. So again, no hesitation in holding that it has that permanence. On the choses in action and choses in possession, again, judge dealt with it very quickly and said this whole argument is a red herring. That 1885 case isn't confining the two property categories in his view. And he felt they were choses in action. And again, dealt with it very, very, I mean, there's definitely reasoning there, and it's not cursory, but it's very neat reasoning. And I think very, very useful should this ever need to be argued before the Bermuda courts. It's exactly the kind of reasoning you like. It has a real intellectual and commercial purity.
It just sounds practical. Like,
yeah, you know, exactly.
This is not what someone in 1885, over 100 years later.
Yeah.
You know, come on, let's be real. It can't be. You know, I know that the way how the court system and how these the court cases work and the precedent is like, you know, it's like sacrosanct. But we have to be practical, and we can't be constrained by things. I'm just saying this as a lawyer who doesn't go to court. He can't be constrained by things that no one back then even had in contemplation. Like,
yeah.
It just didn't exist. Like, there are things now that we think of that we don't think of that are going to exist in the future that the future shouldn't be constrained by as well. So
yeah.
That just makes sense to me.
No, I think that's right. And exactly the same with the information. He actually deals with the information question in quite a lengthy part of the judgment. This idea that, you know, mere information and therefore not property. And again, ultimately comes to, I think, the conclusion you and I would obviously come to, which is it's just obviously not correct.
Yeah. So it seems like this case in New Zealand is going to be, because of the breadth, because of the subject matter, because of all the points it touched on, as it progresses, or if it progresses further through the sort of appeal system and goes to the higher courts, then this may become the leading case on determining that crypto is property.
Yeah, what I would expect to see certainly in England is when this next comes before the court, that someone will, the one issue is that often English lawyers don't look to New Zealand for authority. So it's kind of like someone will need to have come across it in the way that I have. But I expect that someone will cite it to an English judge, and that will be the bouncing off point.
Right.
And then, of course, that English judge, that his or her case will become the main one. And certainly if this was before a Bermuda court, I would not hesitate to put this kind of judgment before our court and say, well, let's have a look at what they're doing in New Zealand.
Yeah, so that's all been very interesting. And I think the sort of my main takeaway in listening from this is that, you know, I think dealing with the property issue and is key, because once that's settled and once that is, there's no argument or there's no ambiguity rather about it, then dealing with the case or having a case in Bermuda becomes just like any other asset class.
Yeah.
It just takes something off the table, and then it's okay, if there's an issue, if I'm a customer of an exchange that is in Bermuda, is a Bermuda exchange, and these are the terms of my contract, I have an issue, I can go speak to Hannah and she can help me to understand what recourse there may be. Equally, if I'm an exchange or other sort of crypto provider in Bermuda and or have some sort of touch point in Bermuda, and there is a situation where I may need legal advice, I can go speak to Hannah, because this property matter is off the table. It is an asset. It is property. Either I own it as the customer, or I am responsible for it as a trustee, perhaps as the provider mm-hmm. of the services. And so really what it does is it makes it that much more easier for us to understand. And again, I'll say to the listeners, whilst we cannot predict what a Bermuda court or any other court will actually determine, we can start to see the sort of signs, as it were, from these cases in the UK and New Zealand, which point to the fact that there is certain level of level-headedness,
yeah.
I would say, a certain level of just being pragmatic and common sense in the approach to this new area, which is going to bode well, I would say, for ultimately whenever this situation does come up in Bermuda, we will not be scrambling, as it were. It will be, okay, judge, this is what it is, this is what others have said, And that brings the whole sort of certainty, equal certainty, because we already have legislation in Bermuda that is really certain, which is really clear, and the government has gone through great pains to put that in place. And so I think that that just makes our own situation in Bermuda that much more attractive for persons who want to come and set up their enterprises here, because we have that sort of legislation and we have the sort of knowledge that the courts will have common sense, practical cases that can be relied upon.
Yeah, yeah. And you're going to wave the legislation in front of the court and say, well, obviously our legislature intends these things to have, you know, to be property, to be claimable and so on, all of those things.
Yep.
And you know, in on the rare occasion, I've never seen it happen, but should the courts go wrong, or should the courts say, look, I don't think I can do this, it's a matter for the legislature. One of the great things about Bermuda is that we're very dexterous in that front. Right. You know, if we need legislation, particularly for something like digital assets, where we've been such a leader in getting, in making a sort of governance and regulatory environment that's encouraging to business, you know, I've no doubt that the government would move very quickly to say, well, you know, this is what we really need in the commercial environment. The judge says he can't do it, so we can legislate for it. Let's sort it out.
Agreed. Well, Hannah, this has been great. I think that there's much more for us to talk about. For our listeners out there, if you have any questions on sort of the litigation aspect of digital assets, or just in general on litigation in Bermuda, please reach out to Hannah. She's one of our preeminent practitioners, as I said. Her details and contact details will be in the show notes. If you have any questions on just digital assets in general without litigation, please contact me, Jerome Wilson, again for your information. We thank you for listening, and we hope that you'll listen to other episodes that we will put out. Thanks very much.